Today's episode of The Thriller Zone is sponsored by Blackstone Publishing and the brilliant new techno thriller 4 Minutes by the number one internationally best-selling author duo, Brian Andrews and Jeff Wilson. 4 Minutes is available now from your favorite bookseller.
Hello, I'm David Temple, and you're tuned into The Thriller Zone, a podcast that gives you a front-row seat to the best thriller writers in the world today, as well as occasional up-and-coming writers whom you'll be hearing from in years to come. One such author is today's guest, a man you may not be familiar with yet. His name is J.B. Stevens. He's a veteran, a U.S. Marshal, and a writer of short stories. There's a lot to enjoy, and you don't want to miss a minute of it. So let you and I get into the Thriller Zone.
What's up, handsome?
Hey, David, how are you?
I'm excellent. Shooting it vertical style, huh? Giving me the Instagram look, huh? That's tasty.
Is that preferable? You know more about this than I do.
Yeah, that's quite
preferable. You're the pro. I looked up your bio. You're the pro of this.
Well, I've been at this for a while, buddy.
All right, I trust your judgment. Is this my best look right here?
That is. Now, if you move your, this is great. If you move to your left, we'll have that 38 right at your head. It'll look like somebody's, yeah, there you go. That's good, yeah. I just now learned that J.B. Stevens, that J stands for John.
And my middle name is Bartholomew, so... It's not a pen name. It's just my initials.
Yeah. Excellently done. Well, welcome to the Thriller Zone, JB, John, JB Stevens, extraordinaire.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. I would pull up I hold up a book and go, hey, look, we'll be talking about a therapeutic death in a moment, but.
Publication was delayed. It stinks. It was supposed to be out on the 4th. I was looking to see if I could get a cover for you. It was supposed to be out on the 4th, but you know, that hasn't happened. Shotgun Honey Books, they're great people, but yeah, the publication got behind. So I'm pulling up the cover. Hopefully any day now it will be out. There it is.
Yeah. I'm going to pull it up on the screen and make it super sexy, but I liked watching you. Dude, that looks like a movie poster, and this is a compliment, by the way. It looks like a movie poster is from probably the late 70s, early 80s.
That was the goal. Excellent. Like Sean Connery era James Bond.
Thank you. Okay, good. Now, you know what? Screw it. Let's jump into it. I want to know where a therapeutic death came from. Now, I do notice, having read a gaggle of them, I didn't read the entire compilation of short stories, but I got through a pretty good amount of them, and they're all having to do with death. So where does a therapeutic death come from?
So one of the stories, the two main characters committed a war crime together about a decade prior. And the war crime is never outlined. It's just hinted at. It's kind of hinted around. One of the characters moved past it, and he started a landscaping business and has a life. And the other character, he didn't move past it. He's mentally stuck in the past. He ends up becoming an opiate addict. And I don't want to give away the story.
Right.
I don't want to give away the ending. But at one point. The character who's done well has realized the best thing he can do for his friend is to just kill him. And it's not even a murder. It's really just doing what's best for his friend. It's like when you have a dog that you love, like part of the family, and you realize there's a time when you just have to put the dog down. You don't want to, but you do it because you have to, and it's the right thing to do. And these two friends, come to that point, and that's where the title comes from.
Why can't we do that to family members? And that's going to sound like I'm being flippant or cheeky, but having seen family members, many of mine suffer in ill health, there comes a point where you just go, man, why can we go put our dogs down, but we can't help assist? You know what I'm saying?
Assisted suicide's that's a whole podcast right there. I mean, there's a lot of countries where you can, but you can't, but the suffering person can. whether or not that's right, like I said, that's a whole other podcast. But I mean, yeah.
All right, let me back up one quick second because I did want to.
Listeners, don't kill yourself.
Yeah. Let's not do that. By the way, I forgot to send you a Valentine's Day card. So a happy belated Valentine's Day.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, I told my wife you're going to be sending me one. She wasn't super cool with it. But, you know, you're only like the third or fourth podcast gentleman to send me a Valentine's. So you know, it wouldn't have been too awkward.
Okay, good. This is what I wanted to. What is the day? And help me with this because I've never been there. I've had another Marshal on the show. But what's a day in the life of a U.S. Marshal like? I'm fascinated by this.
Did you have Mark Cameron on?
No, he's hopefully on a future show.
Oh, who'd you have on?
It was J. Todd Scott.
Oh, he's a DEA agent. He's not a marshal.
I apologize. I feel like a real ignoramus, but...
So did you ever see the movie The Fugitive?
Yes.
The movie Con Air?
Yes.
Did you ever see the movie Eraser with Arnold Schwarzenegger?
Yes.
So...
You're them.
That's what we do, but I mean... You know, with every movie, they take like the two coolest days of your entire career, and that's what they make the movie. But that's what we do. So the U.S. Marshals Service is the action arm of the federal judiciary. We work for the executive branch. And what we do is we keep judges safe. We arrest fugitives, federal fugitives on behalf of the federal courts. We bring them in front of the judge and we get them through the judicial process. And part of that is if somebody is talking about, you know, some other criminals, we can give them a new identity, the witness security program. And then another part of that is moving them all over the country, which is Con Air, which is a real thing. And we actually call it Con Air, but the movie's not very realistic, but it is a real thing. And then, you know, when somebody's running from the federal government, we're the ones that find them. But as far as what I do, I've promoted now, so really I just sit in my office and I sign things. So all the guys and gals run around and do exciting things, and this is what I do all day right here.
Oh, so, wow.
Yeah, budgets
is it loaded? Stuff.
Yeah, right.
So this is your day job and I don't want to insult you by saying hobby because we don't write for hobbies. We write because we take it seriously. But is writing a side passion? Is it I'm going to eventually retire one day and write full time? What does that look like for you?
So growing up, I was obsessed with reading. That's all I ever wanted to do. My dad loves to tell a story that when I got in trouble, instead of grounding me, he'd take my books. And that's how he'd punish me. So I grew up obsessed with reading. And when I was about 16, I read a book called The Lords of Discipline. And after I read that book, I was like, oh my gosh, I have to go to the Citadel. So I went to the Citadel and I like tried to be Will McLean. I was a senior private. I emulated this fictional character. And then while I was at the Citadel, I read We Were Soldiers. So then I was like, oh my gosh, I have to join the Army. So I joined the infantry in the middle of a war, which was just not a wise decision. But anyway, so I joined the infantry. I did Iraq. I did all that stuff. And then I read, what was that name of that book? It was a boxing book. I think it was called like Gladiator. So I read a boxing book and then I got real into fighting and I was a MMA fighter for a while. And then I read Elmore Leonard. And I read a bunch of Raylan Givens stuff, Fire in the Hole. And then I became a U.S. Marshal. So then I was like 35 years old. And I was like, oh, my God, I'm such a dumbass. All I do is I read these books and then I do the thing in the book. But the core of all of it was I was like obsessed with these books. So then I was 35 and I was a U.S. Marshal and I had a career and I had all this stuff done. And then I was like, oh, my gosh, the entire time was just the books. So I was very intimidated, but I was like, I'm going to try writing. So I read every single possible craft book I could get a hold of. And I just read craft books and I just wrote and wrote and wrote for years and years and years, short stories. And then eventually a short story got published by a website called Story and Grit, which used to be run by it's defunct now, but it was It was Mark Westmoreland's old Grit Lit website, who's been on your show.
Oh, yeah.
So Mark was running this website, and I got the story published. It was my first story. I was very excited. And then I got a story published by Mystery Tribune. And that story I got paid for, and it was sandwiched between Walter Mosley and then like Brendan DuBois, like these two huge authors. And then it was like me. And I was like, oh, wow. You know, that's it gave me like a real shot in the arm. So I was like, you know what? I'm going to write a novel. So I wrote a novel and I finished the novel, and I realized I was like, what, like 40. And I was like, oh, I was supposed to be a writer. So I had this like 25 years of violent careers because I'd read books about it. And then I realized, oh, I just wanted to be a writer the whole time. So no, being a marshal is what I do. I guess being a writer is kind of who I am. Yeah. It just took about 35 years to realize it.
Well, I'm glad you never read books about terrorists, because I'd hate to see you end up on a U.S. post office poster.
Can you imagine? Or if I've been into cookbooks, you know.
That was going to be my next joke, something about Julia Child. So of all those awards, let's see, because you were a finalist for the Claymore Award. Tell me about that particular award.
So there's a crime fiction conference in Nashville every year called Killer Nashville. And I was I'd finished my first novel, and I was, you know, querying, which is just miserable. And I was talking to a guy, and he recommended, he said, oh yeah, you know, put in for this contest, whatever. I saw a lot of people put in for it and had success, and I put in for it. I ended up being a finalist for it, but I didn't win. And then that was like right at the end of 2019. And I was like, oh, I'll put in and I'll go to it in 2020. And then, yeah, so time kind of stopped. But yeah, it's a crime fiction unpublished novel award. It's not for unrepresented people. So, you know, it's agented authors, any unpublished novel could put in. I mean, Stephen King could put in for it tomorrow.
Here's a question that runs through my mind, and it ran through my mind when I was reading your stories. And this is part analysis, part question. What I like about short stories is the fact they're kind of like, they're like potato chips. You can snack on them, and you get a kind of addicted to them, and you really like them, and you just keep snacking and keep snacking. The downside of that is, or the other side of that coin is, can you make a living writing short stories? Not that it's all about making money, but I mean, we all do need to, you know, pay for the groceries. So is your big plan to continue short stories like a compilation, like A Therapeutic Death, or is it, do you want to go back and try your hand again at that miserable querying, as you put it, and snag a, you know, full length manuscript novel?
No, I'm done querying. I have an agent. So her name's Nikki Terpolowski with Holloway Literary. She represents some great authors. Kimberly Beale is pretty big. So yeah, I have an agent. She's doing edits on one of my novels, and after the edits, I'll do what she says, and then we'll start submitting. So to answer the first part of your question, I don't think you could make a living as a short story artist nowadays. Back in the 20s and 30s, you could. But you know, the pay for short stories now is the same as it was in the 20s and 30s. So, you know, like with a small market, you'll get like $25 to $50. With a huge market, you might get a couple thousand. No, you really couldn't pull a living with that. I love writing short stories, and I have another short story collection completed and just trying to decide what to do with it. But regarding novels, novels were my first love, and I have a couple novels completed, and I have an agent. So hopefully she'll find a good home for the novels. Fingers crossed.
When I was researching you, John, I'm looking at this former military soldier. I'm looking at mixed martial arts. And then I found out you write poetry. And I'm like, wow, that he's got a sensitive side. So, of course, I go right to the, oh, he writes poetry. That's nice. But then I come to find out that there's war poetry and comedy poetry. And, you know, That's not an easy nut to crack. So tell me, how did that come about in your life, and what are you doing with that today?
So the war stuff is like a cathartic, almost memoir kind of stuff. And the comedy stuff is really just my personality coming out, stuff that makes me laugh. And it's funny, I've been nominated for big awards in both categories. I got nominated for a Pushcart comedy, and I got nominated for the Colonel Darren White Award in war, which was neat. I don't know anybody else has done something like that. But the way that started was I've always read a lot of poetry, and I never tried to write it. Then there was a website called The Daily Drunk that had a comedy poetry call, if it was Fast and the Furious theme poetry. So I was like, oh, this is so stupid. I'm going to do this. So I wrote, I think it was Fast and the Furious, it might have been Taco Bell. I don't know. I had a series of haikus called the Triple Gordita Crunch series. And then I had it's called Sangre Real, the Real Blood, about the blood family of the Fast and the Furious series. So I wrote those two poems for the Daily Drunk, and they accepted them, and I just had a blast. The first war poetry book was published by a publisher, but then the publisher and I had a pretty big falling out. So I pulled that book, and that book's unavailable right now. And then the comedy poetry got published by a press called Alien Buddha, which is run by a guy named Red. He goes by just Red. I doubt Red knows I'm a U.S. Marshal for my day job. Shockingly, Red, that runs Alien Buddha Press, I think that he has hobbies that I probably don't have. So Red loves my stuff. And Red's a great guy. So Red, if you're smoking weed and watching this podcast, I'm sorry, I'm a U.S. Marshal. My favorite comedy poem. And it's a poem about how Bigfoot and Yeti are both two gay men, and they're both very lonely. So they meet on Grindr for mythical creatures, and then they have a 90-day fiancé marriage so that Yeti, who lives in China, can get a visa to move to Washington State with Bigfoot. So, like, I was laughing my ass off when I wrote it. Even saying it sounds insane.
Your parents must be proud. I mean, and your wife.
Yeah. There's
So let me ask you that. What's that end goal? What's that big dream? What if all of a sudden I could snap my fingers and make magic happen with this new agent of yours, which I cannot pronounce her last name. Say it again for me. It's
Terpilowski.
Thank you.
Nikki, go by her first name, Nikki.
We'll go with Nikki. Nikki, if she calls you on the phone today and says, hey, JB, you're not going to believe this. You just landed, fill in the blank.
A big five, three-book deal for a Harry Bosch-style series.
Three-book deal with a Harry Bosch-type series. Boy, now, this is what I'm talking about, folks. This is dreaming with specificity, because if you don't dream, if you don't, like my dad used to say, if you aim at nothing, you'll hit it every time. So I'm a big fan of if you're going to dream, dream big, go home, right?
I even know all the presses, because I do a lot of review work, so the publicists are always emailing me. So I even know what presses would be a good fit. So fingers crossed.
Why Bosch? And is your new book Bosch-esque?
If I had to describe it, it would be if Joe Lansdale wrote Harry Bosch, it would be the best way to describe it.
Who's Joe Lansdale? Refresh my memory.
He's a real big crime fiction writer. He writes the Happen Leonard series.
Okay.
So he writes they're entertaining, fast pace. I wouldn't go as far as saying Southern Gothic, but Southern set East Texas crime stories with his two heroes. He writes a lot of horror, but I don't read horror.
Does it scare you and keep you up late at night? Is that why you don't read it?
It does. It really does.
Wait a minute. You fought scared. In Iraq, and you're afraid of horror dreams, or maybe therein lies the part of the equation. Get on my couch, would you? Let's talk about this.
You want to hear a very specific, very funny story about that?
I would love it, JB.
So have you ever seen or read 1408 by Stephen King?
No, I have not. I'm sorry.
Oh, it's fine. So it's a story where a writer is I can't remember the whole story, but in the movies, John Cusack. So he's a writer and he's trying to finish a book or something. I don't know. And he's in a hotel room, 1408.
I did see the movie.
And the hotel room is haunted.
Yes.
You did see the movie?
Yes. Yeah.
So
keep going.
He tries to escape. Yeah. So he tries to escape this hotel room. Can't escape the hotel room. So I don't watch horror movies. I never liked horror movies. I get very scared. I'm watching 1408. I'm in Iraq and I'm at this forward operating base. We'd done a couple of patrols. We stayed at a combat outpost and we'd come back to the forward operating base where you have like electricity and water and air conditioning. It's great. I'm in my containerized housing unit watching 1408 and John Cusack's crawling through the air ducts, trying to get kind of like John McClane style, trying to get out of the hotel room. And then right then there's a jump scare, like a monster or something comes up and grabs him.
Yeah.
And right when that monster came up and grabs him, incoming rocket came in and exploded probably like 100 yards from me. So I threw my portable DVD. This is like 2007 when he had portable DVD players. I threw my portable DVD player and I grabbed my rifle and I ran out to the bunker. And then all the rockets started coming in. And so I'm sitting there and I'm like freaking frazzled. And this one sergeant, guy named Cordova, is standing there and I think he was smoking cigarettes. And he looks at me, "Captain Stevens, why are you shaking?" I said, "Fucked up, man." He goes, you're normally not such a wussy. You might not have said wussy. You're normally not such a wussy. What's going on?" I said, I was watching a Stephen King movie and you know, it wasn't a good idea." "You're watching a Stephen King movie alone at night in Iraq?" I said, "Yeah, Sergeant, I was watching a Stephen King movie alone at night in Iraq." "It's pretty fucking dumb." "Okay." And ever since then, I haven't watched horror movies. I read a couple semi-horror books lately. Cynthia Palau's, her last name's hard for me, The Children of Chicago. And I read John Horner Jacobs, A Lush and Seething Hell. And they're both great. And I enjoy them, but like, I couldn't sleep for days.
I think I just heard about Children of Chicago. It's being made into, is it Netflix that's picking it up, turning it into a series or?
I don't know. I thought I heard something about that, but I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know anything about the books and TV stuff. I don't know anything about that stuff.
Well, if you're going to do, if you're going to get a big 5-3 book deal in the Bosch kind of world, then you better study it up, puppy, because movies and TV shows where it's at.
I 100% agree. But in all seriousness, I'm a writer and I know about writing and I try to focus on writing and all those other things are amazing. But, you know, I have the one goal. I've seen these people that get so caught up with, "I want to do this and this and this and this and this." And it's like, they never are just working towards their main thing. So God, any of those things would be amazing if they happened.
That's
but I'm not
really,
even thinking about them.
That's actually a very good piece, a very insightful piece of wisdom. And, I used to be one of those guys that I would like, "I'm going to have like 5 things going at once. Oh, I can multitask. I can master all 5." And you know, at the end of the day, new study says that you really can't. You're really good for about 1 or 2 things at a time. So that's actually some wisdom you've got there, young man.
Thank you. Yeah. I have a lot of buddies you run a podcast. Like, "Oh, I'm going to do a podcast about writing." And I'm like, that's a good idea, but running a podcast is a very different skill than being a writer. And you're going to spend time learning all the parts of editing and sound and all of these things. You're going to have to spend time learning those. And that's time you're not spending writing. So it's a commitment. It's not just something you can jump into. And I think, you know, writing for TV, writing for movies, trying to get TV deals, trying to get any of those things are all very valid goals and things to pursue, but all of them take time. And, It's got to be time that you're willing to sacrifice.
Yeah, and I got 2 points to make on that. Number one is this. Podcasting is, if you're going to do it right, you have to give it plenty of time. This is a full part-time job, and you know, I fortunately have the passion for it, and I just love what I do. Mm-hmm. And it has been kind of my background for most of my career. But you bring up a very good point, and it's funny you should say this, because I was just talking to my wife this week about this very thing. And I've been double booking since I started the show last June, double booking, sometimes triple booking. And, you know, by the time you read, not to get on your couch, but by the time you read a book and research it and then book it and get the guest and then record it and then cut it, I mean, it's, I think I did the math one day, it's nearly 40 hours a week. So to that point, you know, that's why I'm kind of shifting come March to one episode a week, always going to be on Thursdays, always record on Mondays, because I'm a writer. I mean, I love to write, and I'm going to be, you got to be true to that. And here's my second point, and you bring up a really excellent point, is that I don't know that I would necessarily say, JB, to focus on writing for movie or TV. The key is what you're doing is focus on the story first, and the people in the business, Hollywood business, will come to you and buy those rights for that. So you don't have to worry about writing for movie or TV.
We'll see, maybe one day. I mean, looking at your presentation and the tone of your voice, and how practiced you are, your microphone setup, your editing skills. I mean, all the amount of time invested in learning that, it's got to be massive. Like, you're so good at what you do. And these people that think they can just jump in and start podcasting, it almost feels disrespectful to the good podcaster because, I mean, you're really, really good. And I don't think I could be anywhere near as good as you without a massive time and financial investment. And to assume different feels disrespectful. So, well, your specific podcasting is impressive.
Well, first of all, thank you. I'm very humbled by that. And JB, all truth. I mean, at 15 years old, I wanted to be in radio. 15, and I had my first job shortly thereafter. So I've been at this a long time. And you do have to, you know, you got to make some investments for the equipment too, if you want to shine. If you just want, look. I did a podcast a few years back where I pulled out a very inexpensive microphone, and it was a two-sided microphone, and my wife and I poured a couple of cocktails and lit it up, and it sounded like that. And you can do that, and there are a lot of people out there doing that. They're picking up a USB $29.95 microphone and sitting around going, you know, and just talking, and that's great. However, if you want to compete and get sponsors and really, really fine tune it, because even the video portion of this, now that I'm telling you all my secrets, if it goes on YouTube, I want it to feel as close to being a TV show, out minus the fact that they're compressing the hell out of it. But I want it to feel like a TV show of some sort. So it takes time. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah, I can't even imagine the editing. It just seems so. And like you said, I do a lot of reviews. So I read a lot of other people's stuff, but that takes a lot of time. Yeah. I just read and then I write about it. So it's not a big stretch for me, but for you to read it and then absorb it, be able to talk about it. That's crazy. But, you know, I have an idea for you on that. It would be a huge time saver if you focused on some really good short story authors, because then you could read like 8,000 words and have a great feel for it and be ready to go.
Well, thanks to you, JB. I've got a couple of those cats coming on the show. Let's see. Who have we got here? We've got Ashley Irwin, who's coming up next week. And we've got your pal, Bobby Matthews, rolling in on the last week of the month. So look at
us. They're both big personalities.
And Mark Westmoreland and I were chatting. We've become kind of texting pals, and he has mighty nice things to say about you and Ashley and Bobby. And it's really cool. I'm going to circle back to this statement that I love the fact that this community is so supportive of one another. And, you know, the business I came from, it's all cutthroat, and you would do anything you could to step on this guy to get to the next position. But in writing and in the publishing world, I find the absolute opposite and nothing but kind, gracious, giving people. I mean, you see it on the show all the time.
I think it's because, you know, readers, they're buying more than one book. So it's not like you're all competing for one part as a writer. So there's no reason not to help other people out. It's all positive because helping people helps yourself, and there's no reason not to. So yeah, all these big time authors are super eager to help out lower level authors. SA Sean Cosby, super, super kind. And I mean, I know there's nothing in it for them. There's really nothing I can do for these people. They're just doing it to be nice. So, but I mean, readers buy a lot of books. So if a reader likes, you know, Mark Westmoreland stuff or S.A. Cosby stuff, there's a reasonable chance that they'll like my stuff. So
yeah,
helping each other out, it only makes sense.
Yeah.
So not to stay on the level of Cosby, that guy's so, so dang good. Yeah. Yeah. If people like certain things, if they like, you know, Rip Rawlins, there's a good chance to like Mark Cameron. And if they like Mark Westmoreland, there's a good chance to like Bart Stevens, so on and so forth.
Well, before we start wrapping it up and get into rapid fire questions, which I think I'm going to have a lot of fun with you on this, I want to say two things. First of all, thank you for your service. I meant to shoot out of the gate by saying that. So thank you so much for that. And I wanted to know how you got the Bronze Star. And the second thing I wanted to know is, do you still practice mixed martial arts? So I know that's a little bit of a packed it all in there one, but thank you. How'd you get the star? And we'll talk about martial arts before we move on.
The Bronze Star it's not for valor. It's for service. We're out on a checkpoint, checkpoint 20 on Route Tampa near Sauter City. And I was bringing food to people on a PLS because I was an executive officer. I was like unloading food and then mortars started coming in and exploding next to PLS. So I dove in the PLS and then we started looking and we saw the guy that was shooting the mortars. We started shooting at him. It slowed down a little bit. And then I look over and like I said, I was bringing food. So the way I got food was I went to this chow hall on this forward operating base and I got a bunch of food and put it in a truck and I brought it to my soldiers. Well, I brought a sergeant from the chow hall to come do food service. So I'm in this gunfight and I'm like shooting at these guys. And there's this sergeant that's literally a cook next to me, just screaming, fuck you, fuck you, fuck you. So we finish up the thing and say, fuck you, I'm a fucking cook. You made me get in a fucking gunfight. We get back to the forward operating base and everything's wrapping up and I'm dropping off the empty food containers. And he goes, hey, sir, you can put me in for an action badge, right? It was like you were yelling at me to go fuck myself the entire time. And you want me to put you in for an award? He goes, yeah, I'm going to be the only cook that's got a combat action badge. So now he's like, I'm sure he's like the tough guy with all the cooks.
Sure.
Talking about when he was in the shit. Yeah, that was how I got my CIB. But the Bronze Star is for service. It sounds cooler than it is. Then mixed martial arts. So I was still doing mixed martial arts. I was very into mixed martial arts, and that evolved into getting real into Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, which is like submission wrestling, which is, you know, like choking people and breaking their arms and legs, but not as much punching and kicking.
Just sounds like good fun for everybody. Go ahead.
It is. It's a good time. So I was very into that for a very long time, until my daughter was born. And then between the day job, having a family, writing and mixed martial arts, something had to give. On my list of priorities, it's lower than the other things. So that's where we are.
Got it. All right. Well, as we start to wrap it up, because I know you got your day job, you got phones ringing, you got people coming in wanting to clean your guns and so forth. I wanted to hit us up with a couple of rapid fire questions. One of them's going to be a layup. One of them's going to be a real thought provoker. And then one's going to be, we're going to see what you're made of. Let's start off with what are you reading right now that is blowing your mind?
So I'm doing this on my phone, right? So here's my little phone stand. And so that the height's right, here's what's holding up my phone stand.
Flannery O'Connor. So, what's the book? I can't read the title. The Complete Story. Oh, okay. Gotcha. Okay. All right. So that's what you're reading, blowing your mind.
Yeah. And it's absolutely amazing. She's so good. She's one of those writers that's so good. It makes you question yourself.
Oh yeah. God, yeah. That's a good point. Do you ever, I find that with so many writers that I'm reading these days and I'm like, wow, there are moments where I go, what am I even thinking about? Why do I even get into that ring? But then again, there are people, you know, there's a sandwich for every taste, right?
You and I, we can be the $5 footlongs and she can be the prime rib at, you know, the Palm.
Yeah.
So, but we're still in the sandwich shop.
This last one stems from a conversation my wife and I had over the weekend. You awake in the middle of the night and your house is engulfed in flames. Now, the good news is your wife, daughter, and Yorkie are with friends or family. The bad news is the fire is moving fast and you have to get the hell out. You've only got seconds. What's the one thing you're going to reach for as you escape the blaze?
So in the spirit of the question, I assume, you know, all my, I have like my documents in a full, all of those things are safe. This is one non-critical thing that I'm reaching for, correct?
That is correct, sir.
Either my great grandpa's World War II war medals or my Citadel graduation ring. One of those two things.
Okay. See, reason I ask questions like this, I just like to get inside the mind of the creator because, it's fascinating. It makes for great conversation and you did not let me down. Very nicely done.
Thank you. And the reason the Citadel ring is if you've ever read the Lords of Discipline, it's built up to such an amazing, level in that story that when I finally got it, it was so overwhelming for me. So yeah, it goes back to Pat Conroy and it goes back to books. Goes back to books.
Yep. It's all about books. Boy, Pat Conroy. Well, folks, you can learn more about JB at jb-stevens.com, and you can follow him like I do on Twitter at @IAmJBStevens. It'll all be here on the screen. And John, JB, thank you so much for the time. It's been a hoot.
Thank you, and I appreciate you having me on. And like I said, your podcast is so professional. When you accepted me after all these other huge authors, it was an honor. Thank you.
Well, listen, we're all in this together. We're all just trying to live our dream. And any way I can help you, I know you'll help me. We're just in this together. So get out there and I'm keeping my fingers crossed for you with Nikki. You and Nikki are going to make this thing happen.
Fingers crossed. We'll see. Hopefully 2023, you'll hear about some big JB Stevens book coming out. Fingers crossed.
Awesome. Thank you again, JB.
Thanks, David.
JB's a nice guy, right? That was fun. Okay, now on next Thursday's Thriller Zone, I have the supreme pleasure of welcoming the one and only Bob Lee Swagger. Okay, not actually Bob Lee, but his creator, the legendary New York Times bestselling author and Pulitzer Prize winning Stephen Hunter. Plus, you'll also hear Stephen's powerful 6 key words for creating a successful writing career. It's a don't miss podcast. That's it for now. So thank you once again for taking time from your busy life to listen to this show. It's because of listeners like you who make the gig so much fun. And say, if you have a spare minute, stop by thethrillerzone.com and leave a review. Or just say hi. And actually, if you're listening inside, say, Apple Podcasts or Spotify, you can leave a review right there. 5 stars would be super kind. Alrighty then, I'm David Temple, and it's time for me to go, but I'll see you next time right here on the Thriller Zone.
The Thriller Zone has been presented by Blackstone Publishing in the exciting new techno thriller 4 Minutes, now available from your favorite bookseller. Learn more at blackstonepublishing.com.